I stood on the corner to wait for her. It was about 20 minutes before I spied her making her way towards me. We walked together a few yards down and the road to where a small park was situated alongside the beach. We sat down on a seat and Joyce was the first to speak. "Well, Bing, how did you get on?" she said. "I've done it," I told her. "I've got the job." Her eyes lit up. "How wonderful, Bing. I'm so glad. I knew you could do it. It will be easier from now on." I looked into her eyes. I couldn't fail, Joyce. You and me thoughts, I couldn't fail. I feel as happy as a king, and this is only the start. When I get settled and bring Lenny over and can get a good band together, we will start going places. As long as you are with me, nothing could stand in my way. Joyce took me hand and said, "Bing, if ever anything should happen to me, you wouldn't give up, would you? I want you to promise me that. Carry on, for I would be with you always in spirit." I started growing worried. I grew more and more worried. I said, "What do you mean, Joe? Don't talk like that. Are you sick or something?" "No, Bing," she said, "I'm all right. But please promise me." I was amazed. "I don't understand," I said. But she was persistent. "Please promise me, Bing." The finish I gave in, I said, "All right, if you insist, I promise, Joyce." "Thanks, Bing," she said, holding me hand. "Don't ever break that promise. You have made me feel so happy. I'm afraid I'd better hurry back. Matron will be wondering where I've got to." They got up from the seat and walked to the gates. I said, "Are you sure you're happy, Joyce?" She looked at me again. She says, "Yes, that's about when we were together on Wednesday, you're homesick." I said, "Come with me. Let's go and tell the matron, and you come with me now. Tomorrow, I'll go with you to see your father and mother to explain why you've come home." She said, "I'd love to have been, but I just can't. When I get my holidays, we'll see what will happen then." I said, "If you come, do come back to the island and stay. Could I ask your father and mother to let us get engaged? Would you like that? You're 17 now. Would you like to get engaged on your 18th birthday?" She said, "I would, Bing, yes. Let's wait and see." So she said, I told them I'd only be a minute, I can't stay. So I went to walk further up the road with her. She said, "I'd rather say goodbye here, if you don't mind, Bing. Let's make this place a rendezvous. In future, we can meet and party here, eh? Let me know when you come back to Liverpool and when you can see me again. I'll write to her on Sunday. Good night, God bless, Bing. So long, I'll be seeing you." She leaned towards me and kissed me. I put my arms around and held her close. She pulled away. She said, "I'll have to go, Bing." So I said, "Right you are. So long, Joe. God bless. I'll be seeing you." So reluctantly we parted hands and she set off along the road towards the Sunshine Home. I watched until she got to the corner. She stopped there for a second, turned around and waved. I never moved. I stood and watched as she waved. Blew her a kiss and then she'd gone. I made me laugh. Way back to the railway station and caught the train back to Liverpool once again. All the way back to Merseyside, I kept on thinking how lucky I was. Life was changing. And from now, the pain and sorrow and everything had begun, and we'd be able to find some sunshine together. Saturday, April the 26th, 1941. I got back home off the boat and went to see Len that night and give him the news. I went to the Villa Marina. Len generally went there and danced on Saturday nights, so we had a chat and I met several friends, one in particular, Bruce Bryson again, and I told him the news and I took him to have a little drink just in celebration. Bruce was pleased too, because he always went with us, the band, whenever we played, helped setting up the drums and taking them down and packing the music desk and all those little jobs. He was a good friend, Bruce. Anyway, Monday came around, I went to work, and I was going to write my resignation out and see the postmaster, but he wasn't in that afternoon, so anyway, I was on duty from 5 until midnight. What hours, terrible, aren't they? I thought, still, it's only for another week. I'd seen Lenny in the afternoon and told him I was going to put my notice in. He was delighted at the news. So I was real happy when I went to work, singing away while I was sorting the letters. I'd been sorting for about over an hour when a young postman come and tapped me on the shoulder. I said to him, "What do you want, Jim?" And he said, "Nellie Linton told me to tell you that Joyce Hughes has been killed in an air raid." I said, "What?" He was starting to walk away. I ran after him and put me on the shoulder and turned him around again. I said, "Yeah." He said, "What is it?" I said, "Say that again. It's not a joke, is it? If it is, it's not funny." But Jimmy said, "No, Bing, I'm afraid it's not a joke. She was killed on Saturday night about 10 o'clock. Her father and mother went away this morning. It's in all the papers." Then he turned and walked away. I was dumbstruck. I could hardly move. My mind was in a turmoil and my head swimming. I felt I was going to faint. The overseer in charge of the sorting office asked me what was the matter. "I can't remember, don't know what," I said in reply. So the overseer told me to go outside and get some fresh air. Once out inside in the open, I felt a little better and I walked around the corner to a newsagent's and I bought a paper. And right there in the front page, I read the news of the bombing by a Nazi plane of the Sunshine Home for Blind Babies. The headline was, "Nurses Perish as Children Are Saved from Bombed Children's Home." I read how the nurses had worked getting the children to safety as the bombs came raining down, how Joyce, along with two other nurses, were trapped in an upstairs room. You might have seen any German at that precise moment, I'd have killed them with my bare hands. Why did Germans stoop so low as to kill harmless people in such a way? There wasn't a military target within miles. It wasn't war. It was murder in the first degree. In a bit of a daze, I went across the road. There was a florist shop there, Klukas the Florist. I ordered the best wreath they could possibly furnish to be telegraphed to Birkdale. The girl in the shop asked me what I wanted to put on the card. She gave me a card to write on. After a moment's thought, I wrote, "In loving memory of one day when we were young, Bing." I made my way back to the officer. I was no sooner back when a telephone call came for me. Lifting the receiver, I asked, "Hello, Arthur Adams speak." A voice came back, "Hello, Bing, it's Leslie speaking. Have you heard about Joyce? It was Joyce's brother." I said, "Yes, Les." Nellie Linton, she was a girlfriend we all knew, sent word from the shop. I've also seen it in the papers. It's terrible. I was with her on Friday evening. "Were you?" said Les. "I didn't know you were over there. Mum and Dad went this morning." I said, "Well, Les, I'm afraid I can't say anything else. I've got a lot of work to get through. I'll be up to see your mum and dad when they get back. Cheerio, Les." I put the receiver back on the telephone and went back to the sorting bench and restarted sorting. What I went through that night, nobody will ever know. The offer seemed to be spinning. I could reach in that headline over and over and over again in front of me. Eyes. From being a happy-go-lucky, young, fun-loving bloke, I was dead. Dead as sure as if a million bullets had come tearing into me body. From that day, my whole life changed. I was a different person, and I've been ever since. That night, as I walked home from work, the streets were dark and deserted. Each corner I passed brought back a memory. Victoria Street, where they'd met on the first date. The library where she used to go and change her books. So full of life. Hill Street, where the Sunday school was, where she used to attend. And I stopped when I arrived at the door of the house she lived in. The door through which she had walked thousands of times, and where we'd stood and talked so many times. I looked up at the window of the dining room, the room where we had waltzed around. The music seemed to drift in me ears, and she used to look through the same window to see me if I was waiting for her. And the room up above was a bedroom window, the room where she used to sleep and dream her dreams. The one she used to tell me about. After a while, I arrived at Bucks Road and onto the main road and home. When I got in the house, my supper was waiting for me. I couldn't face it. I kept going over my mind all the time. I could picture the bombs dropping, shattering the building, the walls tumbling in. The screams, and all after that, all that was left was a cloud of smoke and dust, and deadly silence. I kept repeating it over and over. I took the paper, a newspaper in my pocket, and read it all over again. It wasn't a dream. Joyce was dead. Gone. And I'd never see her again. Never hear her voice. Her laughter. Never more I'd listen to her philosophy. Her troubles. Her jokes and the thousand and one things she used to talk about. All night I sat there. Went upstairs, got to bed in the early, as dawn was coming. I couldn't sleep though. After a few hours, I got up and I went out. And for the next 48 hours, I don't know where I was, what I'd done, what happened. I remember coming to in Ramsey, sitting on a bench on the promenade, and a policeman asking me what I was doing there. What happened those 48 hours, I don't know. People coming up to you and saying how sorry they are, and then someone else, and then someone else. People don't realise how much it hurts when one after another they're coming up to tell you the same thing, how sorry. How could they know? How could they possibly know how sorry you feel? On Thursday afternoon I called the Joyce's house to see her mother. Her mother answered when I rang the bell and she invited me upstairs into the sitting room. She was dressed in black, which contrasted greatly to the paleness of her skin. Her eyes were red. All the crying she'd done in the past few days. She sat on a chair after she'd offered me a seat. I didn't quite know what to say at first. Finally, I said to her, I felt I had to come see you, Mrs. Hughes, to say how sorry I was for you when I heard the news. I didn't get to know until Monday. She said, we received a telegram on Sunday morning. I'm sorry we didn't let you know, but I'm sure you understand. We went on Monday morning's boat. We were able to see her before they buried her. She just looked as if she was asleep. Her face wasn't touched at all. She looked very peaceful. We were informed that death was instantaneous and that she wouldn't feel anything. She had a lovely funeral. The coffin was draped with the Union Jack. And there were many, many flowers. We couldn't face the ordeal of bringing her back home to the island. It would have been too much for us, especially me. I couldn't have stood it. She was buried in Birkdale Cemetery, which is reputed to be the most beautiful cemetery in the British Isles. The grave is on a hill overlooking the sea, and she rests facing the Isle of Man. I was crying as I listened to her words. And then I told her, I saw her only last week. She said, I believe so. How was she? She looked wonderful, I told her. She seemed very happy. She asked me all kinds of things about Dorothy. She loved Dorothy. Her mother said yes. She thought the world of her. Then Mrs. Hughes arose and she walked to a sideboard. She opened a drawer and withdrew a registered letter. She handed it to me, saying, this is yours. Yes, I replied. I sent it to her on Sunday. I wanted to have a photograph was taken especially for me. I had one taken to send to her. Thank you. I'm afraid I have to go now. Can I come and take little Dorothy out for a walk sometime? Mrs. Hughes smiled and said, certainly, Arthur. You know you are only young. You must try and forget. Time is a great healer. She could see how hard I'd taken it. I said, thanks. I'll call for Dorothy on Saturday morning about 11 o'clock. I'll be gone now. Goodbye, she said, and held out a hand, and thanks for coming to see me. On Saturday morning, I took Dorothy for a walk. She was a lovely little child. I imagine Joyce must have been just the same when she was so small. Such saying she had. She could speak marvellously for her age. She was only about five. And not during the walking in the morning, she often mentioned Joyce. When was Joyce coming home? And she loved Joyce. All this. Not. She'd never realised that she would never see her older sister again. Not on this earth, anyway. Every time she mentioned Joyce's name, it made me heart wince. I took her for several walks. She helped a lot to cheer me up in the, with her chatter. And it seemed as if she knew every horse, dog and cat in the town. She stopped every time we passed an animal and talked to it. Those little walks with Dorothy did help me. And on one occasion when I called for her, Mrs. Hughes gave me the photograph that I'd sent to Joyce, the framed photograph. She gave me that back. And she also gave me Joyce's autograph album as a memento. But it was Joyce I wanted, not mementos. The days went slowly by. It was really miserable. The work at the post office got worse, bigger and bigger, and asked to do more overtime. It was getting me down. And I carried on with the band, but my heart wasn't in it, and got asked to play at a few functions. I never bothered at accepting them, and because this wasn't much good to Lenny or the Lenny Uden or the other boys in the band. And they started to get a bit discontented too. It went on and on. I kept walking past the house on the way to work and home, looking up at the window, expecting to see her there. I walked that way to work, backwards and forwards, and every time I passed the house, the memories kept flooding back. Occasionally I saw Mother and had a few words with her. Well, it was just absolutely beyond it. And then Lenny said to me one day, he said, "What about that job at the Rialto Ballroom? Have you heard from them?" And I said, "No, I haven't heard." So he said, "Why don't you write to them again?" So I wrote up and said I'd had a bereavement and couldn't attend at the time they'd asked me. Would it be, if I came over to the mainland, could they give me another interview? But a few days later, I got a reply, and it said, "Dear sir, in reply to your letter of the 23rd ultimate, I am sorry to say that the position has now been filled. Yours faithfully, Gorman British Picture Corporation Limited." And it was signed by the divisional superintendent. So that was it, the chance had gone. So occasionally I played with the band. I joined a club where every as new orchestrations of the new tunes came out, they forwarded them to me, and I kept buying them. Saying, "Oh yes, it'll be all right, I'll be all right, and start again later," but it didn't come. I kept seeing little Dorothy out for walks with her mother. Occasionally I went and took her out for walkies. Life at home with my sister and father was pretty miserable because I was short-tempered, and everywhere I went round Douglas when I was off duty, I'd see things or places that reminded me of Joyce. Oh, it was, words can't describe how I felt at that time. I kept feeling if only I was in the forces back in uniform doing something, it wouldn't be so bad and I could get some sort of revenge. One day I was reading the paper, a newspaper, that there was an international air force fighting in China, an American squadron. I got an idea in my head, if I wrote off there. Could I join that? Seeing I couldn't get back in the British forces. I wrote off to the Chinese embassy. And then it was a mad idea, I know. A few days later, I received a reply. It said, in reply to your letter, undated, we wish to say that while appreciating your sympathetic sentiment, we regret that we have received no instructions from the Chinese government to enlist anyone from abroad. And it was signed, yours faithfully, E.N. Ho, Vice Consul. I know it was a mad idea, but I kept thinking if I could only get back, and then I got the crazy idea to write to the Russian embassy, because the Germans were pushing hard in Russia. I thought perhaps I could get in the Russian army. So I wrote to the Russian embassy, but it was no use. But a week later I got a letter saying, dear sir, I am writing to thank you very much for your kind offer of service, which is greatly appreciated. I much regret, however, that at the present time we are not able to avail ourselves of your offer. But should the opportunity arise, I shall have much pleasure in getting in touch with you again. Yours sincerely, B. Krotov, Consul General. Nobody seemed to want me. Same. Things were getting worse and worse. And then another day I bought a newspaper. I went and sat on the seat. I used to sit with Joyce on the promenade in the shelter, reading the paper. And it was saying about what a bad time the Merchant Navy was having. So many ships being lost and crews being lost. The U-boats seemed to be winning the Battle of the Atlantic. I read it and stared out at sea. I was looking towards the Lancashire, was just over the horizon, and thinking of Joyce there, how she said she'd loved the sea and would have been a sailor. Well, we went that night to the cinema in Walpole Avenue, the Royalty Cinema, and there was a film on. It was called The Long Voyage Home. It was about a Merchant Navy ship in the war and being bombed. I went home and I couldn't get it out of my head, so I sat down and I wrote a letter toward the Ministry of Shipping office in Liverpool, asking if I could join the Merchant Navy. Whilst I was waiting for a reply from them, I told Lenny Uden. I thought it was time I packed the band up, give it up, so I'd quite a library of orchestrations, which I said Lenny could use. We got a band together himself, he could use the orchestrations till the end of the war, and I would, when the war was over, I'd come back and we'd start again together. So he thanked me for that, and I sold me drum kit. I didn't get rid of the music desks, I kept them, I put them up in my sister Winnie's attic to keep for after the war. Eventually, about a week later, I got a letter from the Ministry of Shipping saying to report to Liverpool for a medical examination. So I got a couple of days off work and I went across. I didn't say anything in the post office to anyone, or my father, or sister. Anyway, I went away and I saw a doctor there, and they didn't give it. They weren't too bothered about medical checkups with the Merchant Navy. They were losing so many men and they were taking anyone. There were boys as young as 14 and men as old as 70 sailing on the merchant ships.
The doctor told me that he was all right. So I went back to the main office and they told me to go back home to the island and they would call upon me in a short time. I told them I didn't mind waiting, but that's what happened. So I came back and I went up to see the postmaster. He was a very, very strict sort of a chap. People used to say I hadn't had much to do with him. His name was Mr. Gibson. He was quite a big man. And he spoke with a bit of a lisp. So I went and asked him, or told him rather, I said, I'm going to leave to join the Merchant Navy. So he said, oh, you can't now. He said, you've been discharged from the Army twice, Adams. And now, he said, you're the only regular clerk I've got. From pre-war days, he said, and there's such a thing as essentials works order, which I'm sorry, he said, I can't let you go. So I told him, I said, I've had a rough time, Mr. Gibson. I feel I can't go on any longer than I am, I said. He said, oh, I know you've had problems. I've heard about them from others. And the other staff members, he said, but still, I can't let you go. So that was it. Anyway, at the end of a week, a wage packet came from the Merchant Navy Reserve Pool. So I realised, another week went by and I got another wage packet. I was getting my post office wages. I realised it couldn't go on. So I went up and spoke to Mr. Gibson again. I said, please, can I get your permission to leave and join the Merchant Navy? So he said no. So I was working downstairs in the corner of what they call the sorting office, where all the sorting was done. And in the corner of the sorting office was a little square corner with two walls making a small room. And that was where all the registered mail was dealt with. And I was on this job at the time, the registered mail. And come about 5 o'clock, and quite a few postmen in the sorting office facing the letters up and stamping them and putting them out ready to be sorted. And the overseer was in his little cubicle next to mine. Anyway, the door opened into the sorting office from the stairs from the next floor, and Mr. Gibson walked through the door, come in and started to walk to the back entrance. I couldn't stand it any longer. I opened the door of my cubicle and shouted to him, I said, I'm leaving this bloody place. I'm fed up with this bloody place and you. And there was hush, everybody stopped working. There must have been about 30 people in the sorting office. But he never moved. He walked to the back door, to the back entrance, and he just stopped and turned around. And he says, I know that, Adams. And he walked off. I could have fallen through the floor. The overseer come round to see me. His name was Taggart, George Taggart. He wasn't a very nice man. Anyway, he started bawling me out and telling me what I could do, what was going to happen, I'd be. So I told him, I just didn't care. I told him, I said, you can stop your bloody job, I'm not interested. So I carried on, finished work, and then the next morning, I wasn't done work until the afternoon, but I came down in the morning and I went to see Mr. Gibson to apologise. So I went upstairs to see him, and I knocked at the door and he shouted, come in. So he said, well, what is it now? So I said, I've come to apologise, Mr. Gibson. I said, but I just got to get away. I've got to do something in the war. I said, and actually, I've been away and I've been accepted by the Merchant Navy and they've sent me wages the last 2 weeks. I just want your permission to leave. So he gave a bit of a smile and he said, I know you're anxious to get away. You're only young, he said, and you've had a pretty rough time up to now. And it's my main reason wanting to hang on to you is because you're the last pre-war clerk I've got left. downstairs, that was meaning the counter and the sorting work. All the others, there were quite a few women in temporary, doing the temporary work until the war finished. As he said, I was the last one. He said, that's why I've been trying to keep you here, Adams. He said, but I understand how things are. And he said, I'll make arrangements for you to finish this Friday, okay? So he stood up and shook me hand and come running at me, put his arm around my shoulder. He said, you're a good lad, Arthur. Oh, Bing it, isn't it? He said, they all call you Bing, don't they? So I said, yes, yes, Mr. Gibson. So he said, I hope everything will go all right for you. So I worked the week out. And on my last day there, I went round to say cheerio to everyone. I went upstairs into the telegraph room, as they called it, on the first floor, where the women worked the teleprinters to Liverpool, and they also used telephones, taking telegrams by telephone. And in charge was quite an elderly woman, Miss Knox, her name was. I think I've mentioned her when I started doing these tapes. She always wore like a shirt with white cuffs and a high white collar and a hair in a bun. Miss Knox, her grandfather had been a well-known painter, artist in the island, I believe, Archibald Knox. And as a matter of fact, there's a public house named after him up in Alton, just outside Douglas at the present time. And she shook hands with me, and then she put her hand in a drawer and she took something out. And she gave me a little pewter flask. And she said, I got this for you. She said, keep it with you always, in case you get torpedoed. I nearly burst out laughing, but she had a few tears in her eyes as she gave it to me. And it was full of rum, a pewter flask full of rum. I thought, what a nice thought. Everybody disliked Miss Knox, but I had always got on with her all right. I thought, what a kind thought. And I said goodbye to all the rest of the women there. The ex-postmaster's daughter, Peggy O'Shea, and there was Maureen Clegg and Irene Clucas and a few more. Then I went and said my farewells to Mr. Gibson, and he wished me the best of luck. And then in the sorting office, a few of the workers down there and a couple of the overseers who I'd known. Well, the overseer that day was a man I had quite a few memories of. His name was Shimon, Charlie Shimon. And he'd annoyed me for the past few months. When I was on late duty on a Saturday night, we used to finish about 9 o'clock. And I used to be rather keen to get off to go and see the boys of the band. They used to meet at a public house in Castle Street called the Old Curiosity Shop. And we didn't get drunk, we just had a couple of drinks and a sing-song. Because at that time, during the wartime, all the public houses had pianos. Sing-songs used to be marvellous. Of course, many of the sailors and soldiers named and stationed there, they used to get in, the places were packed, and it was a quite entertaining evening. But Mr. Shimon, he had a terrific big bunch of keys. He had them hooked onto his waist, onto a belt or something. And all the cash boxes from the counter, where the stamps and cash were kept, each person who served on the counter had their own cash box. There were usually about 8 or 9. And that night, they were put into a safe. Well, this Mr. Shimon, he used to have a big wooden board with the sheets clipped on. And he used to say to me, come on, Bing, now I want you to witness me putting these in the safe. So I say, okay, Mr. Shimon. So he'd open the safe. And he'd say, I'd pick them up and I'd put them in. They were all numbered. I'd say, number one, and he'd tick it up on his sheet until they were all in. And I'd just go to shut the door of the safe, and he would say, oh, no, Addy, no, Bing, no. we'll double check. Take them out now and I'll cross tick them. So I had to get them out. When I got them out, put them all back again. He said, oh, that's good. Then he shut the lock the safe and then you try the handle. And I tried the handle. Then he'd unlock it. And he'd say, you lock the key to make sure it's locked. And I had to lock it and then check the handle. And he'd double check. Then he said, now we'll go up the top floor. It was a 3-story building. And we'll check all the windows. And we went every window in the post office, in the building. Check every window. By the time I was finished, about 3/4 an hour after I was supposed to finish work, I cursed him many a time. But still, looking back, it was quite funny. Anyway, the day came when I had received a letter telling me to report to the shipping office, the Merchant Navy office in Liverpool. So I said my goodbyes to my father. He wasn't in good health. By then he was about 66, I think it was, and he wasn't in too good health, so he didn't want to see me go. He was really upset, I could see that, and he'd spent time at sea, knew what the sea was like. Quite a few people had told me not to go to sea. I remember one Royal Marines officer who'd used to go in to collect post office to collect the mail. The day before I left, when I told him I was going to the Merchant Navy, he said, oh, you bloody fool. I said, why? And he stamped his foot on the floor. He says, well, this doesn't rock. You learn. I often thought of his words when I went away. So my father wasn't too keen on seeing me go at all. Anyway, when I arrived at the mainland, I went and looked around and I got a bed at the sailor's home in Liverpool. So I reported to the office and they told me there was nothing doing that day. I had the rest of the day to myself. So the next morning I reported again and there was still no ship. So I got the train and went up to Southport. I waited out, stood outside the post office where I'd seen, met Joyce on that Wednesday. This happened to be a Wednesday too. Then I got a bus up to Birkdale and I walked up as far as the Sunshine Home for Blind Babies, seeing what a mess it was in. And then I went to the cemetery, Birkdale Cemetery. Then I found the grave where she was buried. And I sat down on the curbs. There was a lovely headstone on which was engraved, was carved, in loving memory of Joyce Bell Hughes of Douglas, Isle of Man, killed by enemy action, aged 17 years. I couldn't ask, but I just sat there and I cried. Sat there for ages. I could see her face up in the sky. I was sitting there. I'll never forget her face. I can close my eyes at any time, even today, and recognize her face. Anyway, the next day, I was told there was a ship. The date was the 13th of the 4th, 1942. And I'd been told at the shipping office they were putting me in the engine room staff. So when I went to sign up for this ship, it was a big passenger liner, about 20,000 tons. Yes, just over 20,000 tons, 20,123 tons. I was told that I was being signed on as a wiper. People used to ask me in later years, what's a wiper? So I used to say, oh, I had to go into the galley and wipe the eyes of the kooks when they're peeling the onions. That was just a little gag I used to have. But anyway, it was quite a large liner. two funnels, and it belonged to the Canadian Pacific Steamship Company, which they called it the world's greatest travel system, the Canadian Pacific. They had four of these ships on the Atlantic in peacetime before the war: the Duchess of Bedford, the Duchess of Athol, the Duchess of Richmond, and the Duchess of York. And they served between Liverpool, Glasgow, and Montreal. They were very flat-bottomed, these boats. Quite high out of the water, but a very flat bottom. And the reason for this was so that they could negotiate the shallowness of the River St. Lawrence on the way up to Montreal. That's the reason they were flat-bottomed. But of course, being flat-bottomed, they rolled quite a lot. And the nickname for the Duchess of Bedford was the Drunken Duchess. More about that later. Anyway, with the Canadian Pacific system, you could travel from England to Montreal on the Duchess boats, then travel by train right across Canada to Vancouver, and then at Vancouver, across the Pacific to China and Japan, they'd forced somewhat larger vessels, and they were called Empress boats. There was the Empress of Canada, the Empress of Russia, the Empress of Japan, and the Empress of Scotland, so that you could travel all the way from England right across to China or Japan on the one ticket. Quite an amazing system. And they'd been, all of these ships had been converted into troop carriers, and they carried an enormous number of troops. I just forget how many troops we carry, about 5,000, if I'm, my memory serves me right. And I think the crew was the crew numbered about 325, something like that. But they were immaculate ships.